Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. This is the first part of two podcasts sharing my conversation with a very special guest, Leslie Brissett. The second part of this conversation will be released in our next episode. Leslie is the Director of Group Relations at the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. He's also their company secretary. And Leslie moves between St. Leonard's in Sussex, and I'm talking to him now in Arkansas, USA. Leslie, hello, how are you doing?
Hello, Simon. All is well, all is well, all is well. A nice clear sky here. And it's good to be talking to you.
Yeah, so welcome to this podcast. We thought we'd discuss race, identity, and society. Three things close to your heart.
Well, I think, what do those three things represent? They are like the intersections of our beingness. It's the gets to the heart of our ontology. How do we show up and live in this thing called life?
Precisely, in this thing called life. When asked about your own identity, how do you describe your identity, Leslie? How would you describe yourself to our listeners?
As an identity, I feel like I am a question mark that's unfolding itself. So I live in a black male body. I grew up in London as a child of immigrant parents from the Caribbean. I have loved many people in many guises, shapes, and forms. And I've been curious about life all the way through. So my identity, I haven't got the right label for it, but I'm hoping that I could say that I am human, fully human.
Fully human identity. And it sounds like there's a fluidity about you, that you're on a journey rather than, you don't see yourself as a fixed, I can see, more of a movable exploration. Is that be correct?
I think that my encounter with the layers of myself is a journey. I'm not sure that I am the journey, but as we travel through this three-dimensional structured way of thinking about time, the who I am today on the 18th of June 2020 is not the who I was on the 10th of October 1980. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't any real clear line of sight. But I know that I was both of those beings and still am in some way. But yeah, how do you find your sense of identity? What does that mean for you?
Like you, I think it's a discovery, a journey. I'm interested in how I've been fixed by people's gazes. I got very taken when studying psychoanalysis and identity. I read Franz Fanon and found his work very revealing and moving. And he wrote about how the other fixes him with his gaze, how he became sort of non-human, really. He was he took on other people's projections of TomTom's cannibalism, intellectual deficiency as a Negro in Paris, and that was in 1950s. And I'm been interested in my own identity, how I've been fixed by people's gazes in my white body, in my kind of white male body. I think there's something very, very definitely difficult coming out of my throat. And it is to talk about the sort of a working class identity. You know, I got thrown out of school at the age of 16. I worked in a factory. And then a different time of my life, I found myself as a professor in a business school and university, and finding it very strange how people treated me differently. And I still carry with me that working class boy who was called stupid on many occasions, and internalized that kind of feeling of being stupid. Yeah, you know, you weren't expected to achieve anything. Failure from school. And that was me and my friends, really. That's what kind of what we grew up with. And then to find yourself in a very different position, you know, as author of books and PhD and professor, and how people kind of project that, the different identities upon you, I still find extraordinary. You know, even at this stage of my life, I find it very almost confusing.
But isn't it interesting that, and when you were talking about Fanon, how he said he was fixed by people's gaze, but there is a process of fixing. It's like an exchange, isn't it? So they have a story of you, and then that meets the story you have of you. But at what point, and what is it about what they're fixing that you then take in, introject, resonate with, that becomes a kind of truth for you? So I've always been curious about that, because at school, and you talk about school and what teachers said about you, I was one of those kids that didn't really belong to any one of the groups. So there were the sporty ones, there were the really super smart ones, there were the criminal ones, and there were the ones who were just taking up space. And I would float between all of them. I had friends in all of the groups.
Yeah.
And so it came to a head at one point when at the end of our GCSE year, and a teacher saw me, and I was with a group of kids who were all in, and in the days they used to call it the special classes they used to go to. I was with them in the corridor, and then he said, "You all need to get to your classroom." So we were being herded along, and I had to leave because I was in the top class for English, because we had stratified sets. And yeah, the teacher wouldn't let me go because he thought I belonged with my friends, in inverted commas, and was telling me I needed to go to the special class. And I was like, no, that's my classroom there. And he wouldn't let me be where I was meant to be. And I was like, oh, this is odd. But we do get fixed by others.
Very much so.
And for me, that's like an invitation to question.
Yeah.
You know, so when you talk about your white male body, do you feel white?
It's an interesting question. I mean, when I moved to London, I went to live in Tower Hamlets, which is the largest Bangladeshi community in Britain, and I chose to live. It was like a purposeful kind of move because I felt comfortable in that community, in that multi-ethnic, and taking up a minority position. And I feel very uncomfortable in all white society. So my wife is Polish, and one of the things I don't like about Poland is the homogeneity of it. It's like a 95% white culture. And that makes me feel uncomfortable. And I don't think it's about being white, actually. I think it's about like a monoculture. I think it's about monocultures make me feel uncomfortable.
Mm. But don't, again, so for me, there is this thing, and I've always had a thing about red hair.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many different varieties of red hair, from the really rich, burning red down to the slightly strawberry blonde and everything in between. And the different redheads have different degrees of freckles. And I've always been fascinated by it. So in a way, when you describe whiteness as a homogeny, it's so rich in its phenotypical manifestations of whiteness, but somehow we inhabit the labels that people put on us, and then we stop seeing the nuance.
I think these binaries, white and black, are very problematic. You know, I think, you know, for me, like, I am white, but it's like you say, what kind of white? And I'm a Bristol man. You know, I had a very strong Bristol Southwest accent when I was younger. It's retained some of it. And now I live in Ireland, where people are white, but I'm English rather than you know, people identify by the way I speak and see me as an Englishman living in Ireland, although I've applied for citizenship. But there's a whole diversity within that, and a very rich diversity around the intersectionality of all this, which interests me when we think about identity. This idea that we you're not just white or black or male or female, that there's kind of layers and layers of this stuff.
Yeah,
stuff in us.
And there's the possibility of change over time.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I was talking to someone the other day. There was a professor whose name I've lost, but I think he's a black gay professor in the US. And he was talking about the trans movements and how liberal progressives support trans people. And but if somebody from a color tried to change, you know, tried to bleach your skin or to try and change your racial identity, that would be seen very negatively. And he was asking kind of what's the difference between wanting to be fluid with your gender and fluid with your kind of racial or ethnic identity. I think it's very interesting what is socially acceptable around fluidity and movement between identity and what isn't. And it's still big questions, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that brings up the issue of boundary. So one of the concepts that's really useful, instrumental in group relations is boundary, authority, role, and task, the BART model. Yeah. And what the identity does, I think, is it brings the boundary right to the fore. And so often when people are talking about racial distinctions, they want to bypass the boundary and jump into, well, you know, we all bleed red if you cut us.
Yeah.
Because there's something about staying at the boundary is really difficult, because you want to take a side. You want to be X or Y. You want to be male or female. So the binary pulls you, in a way,
yeah,
away from the existential trauma of either or and.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is something about the gender that does pull people really quickly into the binary, because the trans movement is all about moving across the boundary. So yes, you happen to have been born in a male body, but you feel like you should be in a female body. And so rather than living with the tension between those two, let's mutilate your body to make you the body you think you ought to have. So I came across the trans movement. I was working on a conference at Columbia in New York, and there was a wonderful staff collection of people who'd been put together. Eliat Aram was directing the conference, and they started to talk about this trans stuff. And I was like, cis and trans, what are these definitions? I don't know what they mean. And so they were trying to explain to me, well, cis means that you've always been comfortable in the body that you were born with, and trans means that you haven't always been comfortable in the body you're born with. I was like, oh my gosh, this is a real revelation for me, Simon. I was like, okay, I'm trans. So am I a trans man or am I a trans woman? Because, you know, I look at this body and I don't really feel comfortable in its maleness sometimes, haven't always done. So I said, I want to explore this further. So I tried to find a trans community. And I thought, well, the community I should probably join is the group who went from women to men. So the trans males, because they would be the people who are discovering and working through their comfort with being male in a male body.
Yeah.
So I found them and they wouldn't talk to me. And they said, no. I said, but I want to work on the issues of being a trans male, and how do I get at peace and comfort with my male body? Then no, you can't come to any of our meetings.
So that's another group, Leslie, you've been excluded from.
They wouldn't let me in. Can you imagine? My horror.
I can't imagine anyone not letting you in, Leslie.
Oh, I have a list, Simon. I have a list.
I think it's worth letting listeners know that we've known each other for, I don't know, a decade or more than a decade. And we started to work I think you met on a group relations conference. Would that be right? Maybe.
No, I think we could have met in 2006 or seven at the Grub.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah.
But I think we might even have met before that. When were you at Lancaster doing the...
2005, yeah. Oh, yeah. Right,
that's when we met.
That's right, you came to my coaching course.
Yeah.
Way back.
When I was at the Center for Excellence in Leadership as one of their chairs, because they had a chairs group of people who were looking at taking up governance roles to do the Institute of Director's Diploma in chairing.
Yeah, anyway. That's good. Yeah, it's quite a long time. What do you think, just to let the audience know, that group relations is a way of studying the relationships of individuality, of groups, of teams, and of whole organizations, and how we how power, authority is enacted, how we take up followership roles. It's really a study kind of human dynamics. And I wanted to ask you, as director of group relations, what changes have you seen over that period, that sort of the last 10, 15 years of working in that field? What stands out for you?
I think the main trend I've noticed is that there was something very prescient in the early work of those Tavistock pioneers who came up with this group relations idea. And they were real eclectic thinkers. So they were sucking in ideas and digesting it from all different angles. And I think what I've seen over time, and it's interesting that we're talking about identity, society, race, is that the application of group relations thinking to our contemporary social challenges has been a growing trend. So there's more and more people thinking about this really deep learning that happens in a group relations conference can also help us to think about social challenges, identity challenges in contexts where there are contested allegiances. So that's been a real growing trend, I think, around group relations. And I think also it's opening up the door for us to think a bit more deeply about what it means to be human. There's a lot of things we take for granted in our discussions as humans living in groups. And in many ways, we haven't moved beyond the early Socratic question of how do we live and do this thing called life together. And I think group relations is kind of circling the issues of spirituality and the deeper layers of meaning making in our conditions, really. So I think it's getting more spiritual, and by that I mean open to things which are both seen and unseen.
Yeah, because it always focused on the unconscious, but more in a sort of psychological way. And you were saying that boundary is being opened up more, and the spirituality is coming into it.
Yeah, I think in the same way that psychoanalysis, and it, from its early roots, was interpreted by people to mean that the analyst knows best, and that you went to an analyst to get fixed with the analyst's wisdom.
Yeah.
And that's often how people interpreted it. But if you look at what was happening, and then over the developments of the various schisms, splits, and schools of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy that's emerged, people have encountered actually there's something in the relationship that is healing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how do we pay attention to what's happening between the between, in the relationship, in the dialectic, in the dialogic, in the relational? And so I think the next stage will be, as people often quote that Einstein thing about a problem can't be solved at the level at which it was created, is that people will start to think, well, what's the next level up to help us move beyond our binaries of race, gender, class? There has to be another unit of analysis that we can think from. And I think it's embedded in group relations, because the idea of the group as a whole is beyond the individual.
Yeah. And in this podcast, the idea is to explore what it means to live a good life and how to create the good society. And again, like deep humanity is at the heart of that question, really. You know, what is it to live? What is it to live a good life?
Mm.
And I guess you're exploring that all the time, really.
Yeah, and I had a very dear pair of friends who we got very deeply into Zen and all things Eastern mysticism. And the question of good and bad and right and wrong and essentially what Jesus advocated, who arguably was one of the first analysts, argued about judge not that ye be not judged. And I think that's embedded in psychoanalytic thinking, and it's also embedded in the consultant stance that you hold in group relations is, you know, what's happening here? What's emerging? What can we pay attention to?
Yeah.
And to not grasp for the right or the wrong or something that Bion mentioned, but very rarely gets talked about in the same way that people give credit to his Without Memory and Desire. He also talked about not grasping after being wounded.
After not being wounded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can I listen to you?
Yeah.
With whatever's coming up out through you, can I listen to you and not go to the place of you're wounding me? Can I just stay with your reality as it appears in the moment? Can I live in the question? Can I live in the not knowing of what's coming through you? And when I think about the people who are taken to the streets about the murder of George Floyd or all the other things, how do we stay in the openness to what is coming through? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be crying and we shouldn't be broken about what's happening, but maybe something is trying to come through that.
And something is coming through. I mean, it feels very powerful what is coming through. I guess we won't know. That will be very emergent what comes out. But what is your experience of living in Arkansas at this moment?
Well, I'm down in a place called the Mississippi Delta. So it's deep south. And all the American people I know who live in black bodies are frightened for me. Mm-hmm. They say, what are you doing there?
Yeah.
You've got to be careful. But I have met some wonderfully kind people in white bodies. But this is a town, this is a place that is carrying the scars, the wounds of slavery and its offshoots in America. And so for some reason, I've been brought here to maybe encounter, is my fantasy real that we can find another way to live and work together? Or do we have to stay in the binary? I don't know. But I'm loving it here, Simon, to be honest. I am loving it.
Yeah.
And it's painful.
Yeah.
Creative.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you're loving it. And it was a surprise when you chose Arkansas as your home.
Well, no, I didn't choose Arkansas. That's the point. I chose the house. I was looking on the internet, I thought, because my family emigrated to America. And I was looking on the internet and I said, well, if I find the right house, wherever that house is, that's where I'll go. And so the house that moved me, and I fell in love with it on the internet. And I said, this is the one.
Here you are.
And here I am. And then people said to me, well, how did you manage to buy this house? I said, what do you mean? They said, well, they would never have sold this house to a black person. And I was shocked. I thought, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Of course they must have known. They said, no, they thought you were English. And English means white.
Right.
I was like, oh, I see.
There you are, and you're loving it.
Yes.
Mm.
And then I discovered that Arkansas is also home to the Ku Klux Klan headquarters.
Wow.
Who knew?
Be careful.
So you need to come over here, Simon, in your white body and hang out in Arkansas.
I'd love to. I did a road trip once down into North Carolina and Virginia, and wow. Just how many different Americas are there? I knew New York and I knew San Fran and, you know, these urban places, and then going into the South is a different game. I had an amazing time, actually. I had a friend who was a Quaker, and he was very interested in plain living. and he had made contact with the Amish who left Pennsylvania because it was too worldly. They were getting fed up with tourists and people up there. So they bought some virgin land in Virginia. They bought a valley, and they created, with no machinery, I think they created these wonderful log cabin homes and schools, and I went to visit them, and it was just an extraordinary experience. It was like walking back into some 1650s landscape.
And with what's happening now and what is still yet to come, people will start to see the wisdom in their way of life.
They were already, they were getting people, the young eco warriors were going to stay with them to learn about their sustainable lifestyles, and that was and they were and they're pacifists. They've for centuries been pacifists, and it was such an inspiring experience, and the creativity amongst the Amish I stayed with was something special. It stayed with me that the time really moved me. This conversation continues into our next podcast to be released in 2 weeks. So I really hope you can join us then to enjoy the wonderful insights shared by Leslie. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.